Good morning, and I greet each one of you this morning. It's a good morning, a good start to the day, I felt like. I enjoyed the presentation there by our brothers from Anabaptist perspective. Something that did stand out to me with that was, you know, if we don't tell our story, someone else will, and then we don't have control over the way that it's told. And you might say, well, what's important about that? But I think when we seed that ground, we seed the reasons behind it. And then it's hard for people to understand why we do what we do if they don't understand the story that got us there. So I thank you for coming out and sharing that with us this morning. For the message this morning, I would like to start by reading a verse out of Proverbs 22. And you're welcome to turn there if you like. I was just planning to read one verse out of this portion. Proverbs 22, verse 1. And this is also where I get the title for the message this morning. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. You know, what is a good name? And why did Solomon think it was worth more than wealth? I'd also ask, is that something that we are still concerned about today? Should we be worried about our reputation? And if so, why? And how much of our focus should be on that? And what is the goal, I guess, in all of that? Is it just so that people speak well of us? Or is there a bigger picture? Then I would like to look at some stories this morning from the Bible, from men and women whose reputation defined them and preceded them. And then we can talk about what we can learn from them, how to cultivate a good name for ourselves and for our church, and most of all for our God. You know, ultimately we need to realize that our reputation is not just a reputation for us personally, but it reflects our church and our Savior. And it's important for us to realize that the things that we say and do affect people's perception of Christianity, of God. If we're professing to be a Christian and we don't live like the Bible lives, it's going to affect the way that their interpretation of Christ. It's going to affect, and it could even lead them away from or towards Christ, depending on what our reputation as individuals are. And I was just kind of reminded of that recently, and I want to give two quick stories here of something that happened in our community. The one happened to us and to the business we have across the street, and that story starts with a big project that we're doing for a religious group of people who are not Christians. They're actually quite different in most of their beliefs from Christians, but we've been doing work with them for several years, and we recently did a big project for them. And during that project this last time, there was a misunderstanding came up about what was all included in the initial bid. And I was quite convinced, and I remain so, that misunderstanding was mostly on their end. It was something that we had not included in the initial bid, and it was something that was not talked about in any written correspondence with them, but it was something they assumed was the case. And so as we get started with the project, they say, well, what about this? We say, well, you know, it wasn't actually included in the bid, and you know, it's pretty clear on the paperwork it wasn't included, but it was something they thought was included. And so, you know, it's usually a pretty simple thing of, well, let's just redo the bid. But in our conversations, it became pretty clear that they suddenly felt like we were maybe being a little dishonest with them in trying to add prices after the project started. And we started going around in circles with that. And after a bit, I came to the realization, I was like, yeah, maybe I can eventually win this. argument and we can get this extra money, but what is it going to cost us in the long run? You know, this group of people, they are very sincere, I believe, in their pursuit of peace. A lot of them have left behind successful careers to live in a very isolated place, and they're dedicating their entire days to studying and to meditating and to trying to find some kind of inner peace. And what is it going to do for the reputation of Christ if we fight them on an issue that it was really not a significant amount of money compared to what we were spending already? And so that kind of got me thinking down this road. And it also, another conversation I had recently on another story may have probably done more than anything in setting me down that path. And this was a story that I hope Brenda doesn't mind me sharing, because she was the one that told me this. She's sort of maybe an undercover Mennonite, if you could say. She was in Dollar General a couple weeks ago. She overheard a conversation, and someone went on to say, "Yes, that Mennonite took me for $200 and didn't follow through." And when I heard that, it did something to me. And I don't know, when you hear me say that story, how does that make you feel? It's like, oh, is that really the reputation we have as a church? And based on the conversation, I'm quite certain it wasn't anyone from our church that was involved in that particular business dealings. And it could have been complete misunderstanding. It could have been something that was the person's fault. But why did they say that Mennonite? It got me thinking. It was like, would they have said the same thing if it was a Baptist or a Methodist or even an atheist or a Muslim or a Hindu? I mean, it's, whether we like it or not, there is a reputation that we carry with us. And typically, it's a reputation of honesty, of integrity, and of hard work and, you know, strong work ethics. And I don't know sometimes if we deserve it, but are we trying to preserve that reputation? Is it important to us, if that is the case? And, you know, I say those stories because I want us to ask ourselves the question. We live each day as a person who's trying to further the cause of Christ. Or, you know, in everything we do, in our business dealings, how we treat our employees, or even as a customer of another place of business. Are we the type of customer that they kind of roll their eyes and be like, oh man, I hate dealing with these people? You know, I recently was in conversation with a friend of mine, another businessman, who is working on a project with us, and he was asking me, he said, well, do these people pay? And I said, well, yeah, they pay, but I said, don't give them any kind of deals initially, because they're going to find ways to get you down. Do we have that reputation as Mennonites? And is it a reputation that we're happy with? Or like, are we contributing to that reputation, I guess? You know, like I said, our reputation, not just as Mennonites, but as believers, as followers of Christ, it will affect people's opinion of Christ, and it will affect people's opinion of Christianity. So, like I said, I want to go through some stories in the Bible of people who had good names, why they got them, how they got them, and how we can apply that to our lives today. And the first thing I found to have a good name that you need is integrity. And in Proverbs 11:13, it says, "The integrity of the upright shall guide them, but the perverseness of transgressors shall destroy them." And you know, when I started talking about having a good reputation, there might have been some of you that sort of recoiled at that thought, because you say, well, I've seen too many times where a good reputation is based on something not good. It's about image management rather than a lifestyle. And I want to be very clear. We're not talking about having a good image and preserving, generating an image. We're talking about genuinely having a good name here. It's great damage has been done to the church by trying to cover up sins for the sake of reputation. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit later on more in depth. But integrity is about doing the right things, even if nobody is there to know any different. First story I'd like to talk about is found in Genesis 39, and this is perhaps the best example we have of integrity in the Bible. I'm going to read a few verses out of that. If you'd like to turn there, you could, to Genesis 39. I'm going to read verses 1 through 6. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down hither. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight and served him, and he made him an overseer over his house, and all that he had he put him in his hand. And it came to pass that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, and the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well favored. You know, there's a lot going on here that's not recorded. How does a slave go from an overseer of the estate? You think when Joseph came to Potiphar the very first time, he told Potiphar his sob story about how he was this important son and how he was kidnapped by his brothers, and that's how he ended up here. And he's actually a lot better than a slave. He deserves a management position here. Or do you think he was just put into the field like the rest of the slaves and given the lowliest of spots? I think that probably everything he did right. When he was told to sweep a room, he swept in the corners. He swept under the bed. He did the little things that more than was required, maybe, or at least more than what most people would do. Verse 6, it tells us that Joseph was a goodly person and well-favored. You know, Joseph had a good name, and his integrity in those little things that got him elevated all the way to overseer also went with him as he was falsely accused and in prison. He kept that integrity all the way up to becoming the second in command in Egypt. And God's hand was with him, but it was his faithfulness that gave him the opportunity to save the world, as he would tell his brothers later. The second thing we need to have a good name is to practice kindness and compassion to those around us. And for this story, I'd like to go to Acts 9. And this one is found in Acts 9. It's just a few verses. I'm going to start reading in verse 36. And now there was at Joppa a certain disciple named Tabitha, which by interpretation is called Dorcas. This woman was full of good works and alms deeds, which she did. And it came to pass in those days that she was sick and died, whom when they had washed, they laid her in an upper chamber. And forasmuch as Lydda was nigh unto Joppa, and the disciples had heard that Peter was there, they sent unto him two men, desiring him that he would not delay to come to them. Then Peter arose and went with them. When he was come, they brought him into the upper chamber, and all the widows stood by him weeping and showing the coats and the garments which Dorcas had made while she was with him. But Peter put them all forth and kneeled down and prayed, and turning him to the body, said, Tabitha, arise. And she opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up, and he gave her his hand and lifted her up. And when he had called the saints and widows, presented her alive. And again, we're just given a few verses here of this story, a little look into the life of Tabitha. And there's so much more I would like to know about her. How old was she? You know, was she married? Did she have a family? Was she a wealthy person? Like, did making this stuff, was it just kind of a hobby for her while her husband brought in bread? Or was this something that was a real sacrifice for her? We don't know any of those things. We don't know if she ever personally led someone to Christ, or if she was a gifted speaker or teacher, or even if she had an outgoing personality. But we do know she had a good name. She had a good name in the community, especially with the widows. She was deeply loved by the widows, and we don't even know if they were believers. Perhaps some of them were, and perhaps some of them weren't. It doesn't tell us. But what we do know is they felt compelled to come to Peter and to tell him what kind of a generous person they were. And they brought the evidence with them. They brought the garments with them. And, you know, as I was thinking about this yesterday, I was like, you know, this is an election year this year. And it's already started, but it's going to get a lot worse as Election Day gets closer. All these candidates are going to come out in front of us and tell us what kind of a good person they are and how we should vote for them and how we should look at what they've all done. Think about the contrasts with that and with Tabitha, who was dead and could not argue her case. But it was her works, it was her faithfulness that compelled people to come and to come to Peter and say, look at what this lady has done for me. Look at how well she's treated us and what she's done for our community. And it was them that argued her case, not herself. It was the things that she did, her good reputation. Another thing we need to do for a good reputation is we must keep our word. We must be truthful. In Matthew 5, Jesus gives us this command. He says, again, ye have heard that has been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, neither by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let thy communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. I'm guessing most of you have heard someone pleading their honesty at some point and said, I swear it was this way. And sometimes they'll swear on something. And I don't know what you think of when you hear that, if it makes that any more believable to you. The times I've heard it, it's almost made it less believable, if you will. For sure, it hasn't helped their case out at all in my personal mind. And I wonder if you find that the same way. Jesus is making a case here that you don't need to do that. A truthful person, a person with honesty and with integrity and with the reputation of such, doesn't need to do that. He says, this is how it was. This is how it is. And it just leaves it at that. Do we have that reputation in our community? Do we have that reputation with other people that when we say something, when we give our word is golden? Do we pay back our loans because we agreed to it? Or do we pay them back because they're legally binding, because we put our signature on the paper? You know, recently I heard a story of a Chinese foreign student who was in the United States for 4 years. And while he was here, he built up a pretty good line of credit. This story that I read, he had built up $140,000 worth of credit while he was here. And before he went back to China, he spent $140,000 on luxury items that he took with him back with no intentions of ever paying the loan back, because those statutes are not enforceable in China. And he said, I'm never coming back here. I'm taking everything I can on my way out the door. And I thought about that when I heard that. I was like, you know, would we use a loophole like that if that was available to us? Would we say, well, too bad for you guys. You should have thought about that. Or do we believe that our reputation is worth more than wealth? You know, opportunities become more abundant to the trustworthy. And I would like to read a few verses out of Nehemiah. This is my story for this section. You can find this portion in Nehemiah chapter 2. Start reading verse 1. And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing that thou art not sick? This is nothing else but the sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid. And I said unto the king, Let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Then the king said unto me, For what dost thou make request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. And I said unto the king, If it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. And the king said unto me, with the queen sitting, also sitting by him, For how long shall thy journey be? And when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Moreover, I said to the king, If it please the king, let the letters be given to me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over until I come into Judea, or into Judah. You know, Nehemiah was the cupbearer of the Persian king. And the cupbearer, in my research, it would appear the cupbearer was the most trusted of the king's servants. And the primary reason for that was because the cupbearer was responsible for the wine that the king drank. And one of the most common forms of assassination in that day was to poison the drink before it was served to the king. And so the king needed somebody in charge of his drink who would never be bribed or corrupted to do such a thing. It was a very important role. In fact, as I read, they said it was hardly even considered a servant, because he was more of a confidant of the king. He would often eat with the king. He would counsel with the king. He was the person the king would go to if the king had any kind of, you know, wanted to confide with somebody who he knew he could trust. So this is the position that Nehemiah found himself in. And as Nehemiah felt a call to rebuild Jerusalem, he went to the king. He was very tepid about it, but he had such a good relationship with the king that it appears the king could tell that something was wrong. But because he had the confidence of the king, he was given the opportunity to carry forth the work of rebuilding Jerusalem. The king could send him with full confidence, knowing that the materials that he provided would not be embezzled or wasted, but that they would be taken care of. And again, trustworthy. Trustworthiness is so important in a good name. In fact, if you can't be trusted, you can't have a good name. It's kind of as simple as that. To have a good reputation, you must also take responsibility. This is going back to what I said earlier. Cultivating a good reputation is not about image management. We all make mistakes along the way, and those mistakes should not define us. But our willingness to acknowledge, to learn, and to correct those mistakes, they will. If we don't allow ourselves to learn from the mistakes, those mistakes will become our reputation, they'll become who we are. Whereas if we learn from them, if we correct them, we acknowledge them, we can turn that into a learning experience, and it doesn't need to follow us through the rest of our life. And I was just thinking about this. I thought about the story in Luke 22 of when Jesus confronted Peter before the Last Supper, and he gave Peter a warning. He said, you're going to be tempted, and you're going to fail that temptation. He told him what was going to happen, and Peter said, no, that's not the way it's going to be. I'm going to be better than that. And yet, even with a warning, a clear warning, he still failed his test. He still betrayed Jesus at his lowest moment. But is that how we know Peter today? Did that define Peter and who he is? Did follow him through life, that reputation of, well, you can't trust Peter. He's going to, as soon as the fire gets hot, he's going to be off to running. No, I think we know the story of Peter well enough to know that's not true. In fact, one, just look at the verses in John 21 when Jesus confronted Peter after the resurrection. It's just a few verses here in John 21, 15 to 19 I'm going to read. So when they had dined, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? He said unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my lambs. He saith to him again a second time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Yea, Lord, thou knowest that I love thee. He saith unto him, Feed my sheep. And he saith unto him a third time, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me? Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, Lovest thou me? And he said unto him, Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee. Jesus saith unto him, Feed my sheep. Verily I say unto thee, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself and walkest whither thou wouldest. But when thou shalt be old, thou shalt stretch forth thy hands. Another shall gird thee and carry thou whitherest thou wouldst not. This he spake, signifying the death he should glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said unto him, Follow me. Jesus gave him a second chance. And in this second chance, he told Peter what was going to happen. He said, It's going to cost you your life. In the book of Acts, we read Peter's response to that challenge. He proclaimed the name of Jesus with reckless abandon. He was not cowed or intimidated by the religious or the civil authorities of that land, of that time. He would go on to be crucified for his preaching, for his beliefs, and for his unwillingness to allow or to be backed or to be silenced. And there's few, if any, men in the kingdom of heaven that have been as influential as Peter, a man who failed Christ, who turned his back on him and betrayed him. But Peter didn't allow that to define him. He took responsibility for his failures, and he did not fail the second time when he was challenged. And lastly, to have a good reputation, you must be consistent over the long haul. And this one may be the most difficult, because we can do the right thing one time. Sometimes we can even do the right thing when it's the hardest thing to do. But we have to do the right thing every time if we're going to be consistent. And that can be a bit more of a challenge. And one of the stories I had to think about when I was thinking about consistent obedience over the years was the story of the Rechabites in Jeremiah 35. And you're welcome to turn there if you would like to Jeremiah 35. I'm going to read a few stories or a few verses out of that, of their story. So we're going to start reading in verse 3 of Jeremiah 35. Then I took Josiah, the son of Jeremiah, and his brethren, and all his sons of the whole house of the Rechabites, and I set before them pots of wine and cups, and I said unto them, Drink ye wine? But they said, We will drink no wine. For Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, Ye shall drink no wine, neither ye nor your sons forever, that ye may dwell in tents, and that ye may live many days in the land where ye be strangers. So that we have obeyed the voice of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, in all that he commanded us, to drink no wine all our days, we, our wives, our sons, and our daughters, and have obeyed him in all of our works, and have kept all of our precepts. This is a remarkable story of consistency for generations. And as I was studying this, I guess I hadn't realized this before, but I kind of wondered, well, who is this Rechab and who's this Jonadab? There's actually a story of Jonadab in 2 Kings 10. And this was through their genealogies, discovered that this is the same person who made this command. And I'm going to just read a little bit about him. In 2 Kings 10, starting in verse 15, this is what it says. And this was about Jehu. This was after Jehu had overthrown Ahab, or Ahab's son, I think, as ruler of Israel. And God had commanded Jehu to cleanse Israel of Ahab, and he would basically purge Israel of his descendants, and to get rid of Baal and Baal worship. So in 15, this is Jehu riding out on his chariot. And when he was departed thence, he lighted on Jonadab, the son of Rechab, coming to meet him. And he saluted him and said unto him, "Is thine heart right, as my heart is with thy heart?" And Jonadab answered and said, "It is. If it will be, give me thy hand." And he took and gave him his hand and took him up into the chariot. And he said, "Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord, that they may..." So they made him ride in his chariot. So this is someone who told Jehu, "Come and see my zeal for the Lord. Look at what I'm ready to do." And as you read on this, the rest of this portion, you see that they followed through with the command that God had given them of purging Israel. Jehu did fall back, but that was later. But initially, they carried forth the call of Christ, the call that God had laid on their heart here. So this is the same man who told his descendants, "Look, in my zeal for the Lord, I don't want you to be drinking any wine. I want you to live in tents." And we don't know why he commanded them to do this, but what's interesting to me is this is approximately, according to genealogies, this is approximately 250 to 300 years after his command. 8 to 10 generations later, they were still following his command. And so this is more going away from the individuals. This is more as a church, like our reputation. Can we hold on to our reputation for that many years by consistently following the commands of Christ? So to sum it up, if you were writing down the points and you wanted, maybe missed one, have a good name. You must have integrity. You must be kind and compassionate. You must keep your word. And you must take responsibility. You must be consistent over the long haul. And let's remember that our good reputation does not affect only us as individuals. It affects our family. Our children will be affected by the reputation you have. I think we've all encountered families where it's like you've heard someone make a comment, "Well, that don't trust that family," or "His dad was this way," and it sort of affects the way that you perceive the children to be. Doesn't just affect you as an individual; it affects your family, affects your church, and it can even affect the kingdom of Christ. What we do and how we respond to the people around us can have consequences, either good or bad, that will affect eternity. Let us strive to have a good name for our church and in our community for the glory of God. So this time, if you'd kneel for prayer.